When you're raised on the beaches of Southern California, the sea gets into your blood. For Jonathan White, being a lifelong mariner means dedicating himself to learning what the seas have to teach us. For many years, Jonathan hosted seminars at sea from Puget Sound to Southeast Alaska aboard his schooner, the Crusader. But one spring, a surprisingly strong tide in the Bay of Alaska nearly destroyed his boat. Jonathan turned that into a chance to travel all over the world and gain a depth of knowledge about the mysteries and the power of the tide. He describes what he discovered about the primal forces of nature in his book. It's called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you always think about the tide, but you never know anything about it. It just comes and goes, and I have some foggy idea that it has to do with the moon and gravity and so on, but you've made a study out of this. Now, when you look at the spot where the water hits the land, what do you see? I mean, I'm talking really close up. What do you think about?
Well, I think about the interface of a lot of things, about this big, this massive ocean, which is 75% of the Earth, and of the population, our culture, our life, you know, and our history with that ocean and living on the coast.
Because I think of when I was a kid, you'd build a sandcastle, and you know, in just a matter of minutes, the tide's coming in. You can see the tide encroaching. There's no way to stop it, and
that's
your little
right.
creation is gone.
That's right.
I look at the tide coming in and filling tide pools and then going back out and leaving it for me to scavenge through.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that even goes back to, you know, ancient times when people would actually fish and find a livelihood according to the tide. There's so much, if you live close to the salt water, that the tide impacts your life.
Exactly. And, you know, our ancestors, when they came into this along our coast, for example, it was the first place they settled along the coast. And it was because they could get food in the intertidal zone. So when the tide is out, they could go out and get chitons and urchins and crabs and so forth to feed off of. In fact, the Tlingit people that lived up the coast said, when the tide is out, the table is set.
I love that.
So that's where they settled.
Good.
It was easy to make a living.
And as a kid, I mean, you live on Orcas Island up in
yes.
San Juan,
uh-huh.
right, north of Seattle. And we would vacation there before I ever went to Europe. And we'd leave home for like a month every summer. And my mom would declare, I have no meat. You're going to be living off the land. And that means we're on our boat. And when the tide's out, we were out there getting clams and oysters and crabs. We'd go, yeah. I remember this one bay, it would be a gorgeous bay, shallow bay on Tsusha Island. And the tide goes out and it was blanketed with seaweed. And we would put on our old tennis shoes, and we invented this way of getting crabs. We'd drag our shoes over this blanket of green seaweed, and if you hit a bump, it's a Dungeness crab. And we grew up just feasting on crabs, and you take that back 1,000 years to indigenous tribes here, to Europeans living on the coast. Like the Tlingit people said in Alaska, when the tide is out, the table is set. The tide also provided power before they had steam engines. I'm not talking about modern tidal power generation. I'm just talking about freeloading on the tide. What were some clever things people did? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, back in the 16th century, actually, it was at the same time that they were developing windmills, they were also putting windmill-like devices in rivers and using that power for baking, for making paper, for irrigation, all kinds of things.
You have water mills sitting on a river because the water is flowing by because of the flow of the river. But mm-hmm. you're talking about tidal rivers in this case, right? The water coming in and then going out.
That's right.
So they would harness that.
Absolutely.
And that would be like 1,000 years ago. That's kind of what brought Europe out of the Dark Ages around the year 1000 was they had this innovation to harness the wind and harness the water power and so on. Windmills are popping up, and they would be tidal mills as well.
That's right. I don't think people really realize how long this history is. And so in the middle of the 16th century was really the heyday of tide energy, these mills that we're talking about. And there are thousands of them around Europe. And actually, there were 300 or 400 of them right on the east coast of the United States around the 1750 to 1800s.
And what I learned in, I think it's the Loire Valley and in a river in south of Ireland, people who were traders, they knew they had 2 trips a day to freeload with the tide miles and miles inland up this tidal river.
Hmm.
And then they would flow back down. But they would go up the river when the tide was coming in, and then they would go down the river when the tide was going out.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's like, yeah. Well, yes, of course. But I mean, it just seems remarkable that the tide could be just this low-hanging fruit of available power if you know how to harness it.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's that you mentioned, the cultural influence there, that like the early tide mills on the East Coast, for example, were installed before we were using clocks. So when the big gates closed to operate those mills that had to do right at high tide, the big clunk, that was time for them. It was time to go to work. So it's fascinating just the role it played.
So let's talk about the science of tides. By the way, we're talking with Jonathan White, and he is you could call him a tidophiliac. He spent years just chasing the tide, studying the tide, thinking about the tides. He's written a book called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. So we know basically the moon has a gravitational pull and it kind of pulls the ocean one way or another. You make it much more poetic. In your book, you called the relationship between the ocean and the moon a celestial dance. Tell us more about that.
To harken back a little bit to what you're saying, I started out as a sailor and a writer and really knowing very little about the tide. Like most people, we know the moon has something to do with it, but not exactly what. And it wasn't until this big accident that I had on a boat up in Alaska that I suddenly woke up and said, hey, what is going on here? And I thought I'd just read a couple of books, read a couple of articles, and learn everything there was to know about the tide. I mean, how complex could it be? But the more I read, the more I studied, the more complex, the more fascinating, the more poetic it became. So suddenly I was on a journey 10, 15 years into this and 300 books and so on and so forth. So it's far more complex than most people realize. So it's layer after layer after layer. So yes, the sun and the moon play a major role, but it's all their relationships in the heavens that have an influence, a particular relationship with what's happening in the oceans.
So the oceans, and you started out this interview talking about how we have to remember most of the surface of the Earth is oceans. I mean, this is a big dance floor, if you're going to get back to that celestial dance.
That's right.
You talked about how it gives a new meaning to the term long-distance relationship. We've got celestial bodies pulling that. Now, we think about planetary, or I don't know, the sun and the moon and things lining up. All I know is sometimes you got a wimpy tide, and sometimes you got a real high tide, and sometimes you got a real low tide. What causes the tide to come and go twice a day and sometimes come big and sometimes go big?
Well, let's start with the last part of that. Why does it come big sometimes and not so big at other times? It's really about the various alignments of the sun and the moon. And it boils down to whether the sun and the moon are working together to create larger tides. And that happens when they are aligned. There's a great Greek word called syzygy. It means yoked together. And that's when the sun, the moon, and the earth are aligned. And they are aligned when the moon is full or when it's new. That's when the earth, sun, and moon are aligned. And that's when we have the biggest tides because the sun and the moon are working together. Their gravitational pull together.
So the moon is much smaller than the sun, but it's much closer to the Earth, so its gravitational pull on the Earth is actually bigger than the sun.
That's right.
And if you've got the sun on one side and the moon on the other side, the moon wins out, but the sun negates a lot of that pull.
No, actually, they're working together during that time.
Really?
Yeah, they're working together because, I mean, it appears that they are opposite, but they are, because of the gravitational pull and the forces on the Earth, you're basically having a situation where you get the largest tides of the, say, the month or whatever it is. And then also when the moon is between the moon, Earth and the sun, you also have the largest tides. That's when the moon is new, right?
Okay, so when the moon is between the Earth and the sun, you've got, it's a tug of war and you got two big things pulling on the rope in that direction.
That's right. That's right.
What's the smallest tide? Would that be when the moon, when they're out of sync then?
That's right. So when the moon is in quarter or three quarters, so it's at right angles to the sun. And basically what's happening there is the sun or the moon is robbing some of the other's gravitational pull.
Yeah. Now you hear there's these little oddities. There's different kind of tides. Isn't there a word called neap tide?
Yeah. So it's great that you bring that up because the neap tides are the lower tides.
Okay.
So that's when the moon is in quarter or three quarter, when it's at right angles to the sun.
Now, you could have a freakish situation when things are closer because of orbits. Then their pull, if you've got things lining up and their orbit has them unusually close, you could have a a once-in-a-year tide or a once-in-a-decade tide, I suppose.
Exactly. And the one of the ones that we're familiar with is a king tide, right? So a king tide is when the moon doesn't orbit the Earth in a perfect circle. Sometimes it's closer, sometimes it's further away. Closer means the word is perigee, and further away is epigee, right? So when the moon is in perigee, in other words, closest to the Earth, it's exerting more gravitational pull. So now if you combine that with a new or full moon, you're going to have larger tides, maybe king tides.
And what are those, a good thing historically for people, or are they a bad thing? I mean, what is the impact of those? Does it matter?
Well, I would say that for our ancestors that settled along the coast, they knew about these things. In fact, I'm sure that they had a better practical understanding of the tides than we do today. Yeah. So they knew these things were coming, and they knew during one of the king tides, that means high highs and low lows.
You could roll a big log higher up to your settlement on a king tide.
Or you knew where you can go and get sea urchins that you don't normally get because the tide's going to be lower than usual.
Oh, I gotcha.
So it was a survival.
Sailor, surfer, and marine conservationist Jonathan White is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. He's studied the impacts of tides around the world and shares the mysteries nature has shown him in his book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. His website is jonathanwhitewriter.com. Now, you talk also about how the Atlantic is more strongly tuned to the moon and the Pacific is more tuned into the sun. And you explain that you learned that from Inuit elders up in the Arctic.
Well, yes. I spent a fair amount of time up in the Arctic. I traveled all over because what I basically did in the book is I took some element of the tide and I went to where it was most dramatically at play. So I traveled all over.
As people do when they're studying the tide.
Yeah. Or have to do, of course.
Okay.
I have to go to Mont Saint-Michel or the Arctic or Panama. Or
so you went up to the Arctic and you hung out with these Inuits.
And one of the things that I learned up there, and really the tide is about a lot of different things. As I said before, it's complex. But if you keep stirring the pot, what you get down to is the tide is about vibration. And more specifically, it's about resonance, when something vibrates in response to something else.
Okay. Now, I'm a musician, and I know you get resonant frequencies. If you hit a middle C, a G, an octave and a half above that, will vibrate because if you divide the strings in a certain way, they're both the same length.
Yeah.
And they vibrate harmonically.
Yeah.
You're saying that in a different sense, you've got sort of a parallel kind of resonant vibration going on?
That's exactly how the tides work.
So, tell me more.
So if you, and I'm going to use a little different analogy, but yours also plays out. When you're singing in the shower, we all have that experience.
Oh, yeah, and the whole thing rumbles together.
Yeah, and that shower has a tendency to vibrate.
So you've hit the proper vibration measurements to make everything work in sync.
You're singing along and you hit a C or a D or an F, and that happens to be the oscillation, the natural oscillation of your shower stall. Okay. It'll resonate and you feel brilliant, right? Your voice gets rich and deep and full. And well, if you blow up that analogy to the size of the solar system, the singer is the sun and the moon singing the notes, various relationships that they have, and the shower stall or the ocean basins of the world that all have a tendency to vibrate to certain, if you will, notes
from
the universe.
You're talking actually about the floor of the sea.
Well, no, I'm talking about the basin, the whole basin. That's the shower stall.
Huh.
And we think of, when we look out on the Pacific, we think of one basin, but there are many, many, many basins within it.
I've never said this before, but on the radio, but that is trippy.
It is.
It's trippy. And we're talking tides here with Jonathan White. His book is Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. So it's all vibrating in a sort of a synchronized way.
Like I said, it boils down to resonance. So if you have a tide that is large in one bay, and then not so large, 10 miles down the coast.
Yes, I've noticed
that. The difference is that one bay might be very resonant, so it has a larger tide, and the other bay not.
Because of its accidental physical design.
Its shape, exactly.
Its shape.
Length, its depth, even the temperature and salinity of the water attribute to how this thing is going to resonate. And there are, when we talk about the sun and the moon and all the different positions as different notes, right, in the heavens. Now, there are over 400 of these different notes or calls or positions of the sun and moon that actually have a tide signature on Earth.
Now, in your book, you talked about in Panama, On the west side, it's a 28-foot tide, and on the east side, it's only a 10-inch tide.
Yeah, so there's a good example of resonant qualities. So the Bay of Panama is a highly resonant basin, so it has a very large tide. And as it turns out, the Gulf of Mexico is not a resonant basin. It's a dissonant basin, in fact. So it has a very, very small tide. And by the way, the Baltic and the Mediterranean are also dissonant basins.
I've always been disappointed in that. In the Mediterranean, there's almost no tide.
Exactly. And it's because it's not resonant.
Are there some places in the Mediterranean that are more resonant?
Yes, up towards Venice.
Because I was going to say, Venice does have, I always feel like I'm almost contradicting myself because the Mediterranean's got no tide. But in Venice, when you have a high tide with a certain barometric pressure and a wind, you've got a flood.
That's
so
right.
There is a tide in Venice because of the shape of that part of the
Adriatic
Sea.
And this idea of resonance is not just about the sun and the moon, but it's about all kinds of things that are happening around the Earth. For example, part of the reason why Venice has a larger tide is that the Adriatic Sea is highly resonant with the winds out of Africa.
So it is a complex dance.
Yes.
It is a complex dance.
And by the way, the Bay of Fundy is a highly resonant basin. It's the largest tide in the world at record tide of 54 feet, 6 inches.
In other words, if you're in the boat in the middle of the bay, you could be beached or you could have an anchor with a 50-foot rope and it wouldn't hit the bottom.
That's right.
Depending on the high tide or the low tide in the same spot.
That's right.
Because of the design of that particular bay that brings in the water and pushes out the water as its little small player in this complicated, many-faceted dance between celestial bodies and the ocean.
Yeah, and I actually say it's all of that. The water is moving up and down, of course, but it's doing that because it's vibrating with the sun and the moon. It's like the opera singer singing and the wine glass breaking, right? That's what's happening in the Bay of Fundy.
This is what I love about travel. It gets us out of our routine. And it shows us there are so many dimensions of this beautiful planet that you can get tuned into. And when you travel, you get to hang out with people who have found their niche and they're freakishly enthusiastic about this or that. And it just opens us up to the wonders of this planet. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Jonathan White. His book is Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Jonathan, you've spent a lot of time looking at tides coming and going all across the world. Share with us, just to wrap things up here, one particularly inspirational moment as you were watching the tide at work.
I think of Mont Saint-Michel, which of course is a spiritual destination. And I know you've been there and done programs there. And I went there actually twice. And I ended up interviewing the monks that live and practice there about their relationship with the place, with the tides, and also with their spirituality. And I spent a week there, and it, as you know, it's such a moody place, and it's such a dramatic tide. I would say it was one of the more moving places that I've been to, ever.
Standing on that island where they said, build it big and they will come, and when the tide goes out, it's just stranded in a sea of mud.
Yeah.
And then when the tide comes in, it's a whole different world.
Yeah.
And you saw how spirituality and culture and history and nature and this fascinating celestial dance all came together.
Yeah.
I love it. Again, Jonathan White, the book is Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Thanks, Jonathan, for being with us.
Thanks.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Keith Stickelmeyer read our listener travel haiku. Send us your own original haiku about your travel impressions, and we might even read it on the air one day. Details are on our website at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.